I'm your host, Rena Friedman-Watts, and this is the Better Call Daddy Show.
Hey, this is Big Daddy, Wayne Friedman.
That's my grandpa. Grandpa, you ready for more daddy drama?
My dad is my number one hero and number one fan.
And I'm a pretty cool dude.
All right, season four, baby, here we go.
More stories you're not going to believe.
And maybe you will after you listen.
5 stars.
5.5 stars, 2 thumbs up.
You are a pretty cool dude.
Love you, Mommy.
Don't stand on the table and damn the public. You'll get some words of wisdom to live by.
Here we go again. Better call Daddy.
You know what your problem is? You like me.
Yeah, I do. Each week, I interview a guest, share the stories with my dad, and then he weighs in at the end of every episode with his wisdom and wit.
Hey, Grandpa.
Everyone from influential players to inspirational fathers and, of course, controversial people.
Grandpa, my mom is calling.
Creating that legacy one call at a time. And welcome to the Better Call Daddy Show.
Stay tuned.
Where's the music?
Better call Daddy because he knows you best. Better call Daddy because he's bringing the test. He sees possibilities. Better call Daddy, you're the apple of his eye. He sees possibilities. Oh,
sometimes I am absolutely shocked on how my dad is going to respond to one of my guests, and this episode is an example of that. Today, I am talking to a lady who was raised in a cult and left a cult. She was forced to be her own hero. Relatable Reese, welcome to the Better Call Daddy Show. So I told my dad that I was getting ready to interview somebody who left Scientology and grew up in a cult. And it's interesting how he responded to that. First off, he was like, how has that shaped your connection to spirituality?
That's a good question, Dad. That's a good question. I don't know that anybody's ever asked me that question. Well, spirituality is, I like that word. I don't feel like rigid answering that. But if you were to say, how has it shaped like my connection to religion in general? I'm not comfortable because of that. Spirituality is a different thing for me because I have a husband that passed away a few years ago and I feel him with me all the time. And like, I've, you know, experienced things where I'm like, oh, that was him. So to me, that's kind of very more spiritual. And I have always felt a connection there, like regardless of Scientology. But I'm married now and coming out of the cult, he was trying to take me to church. He's a Methodist. And I was like, oh no. I mean, I tried it. I went with him once. I'd never been to church before. And it was not for me. I just thought I'm not ready for this, you know. Kind of jumping out of one thing and into another. I'm not ready to just start believing something else.
Yeah. You know what else he was talking about? He said that there's a lot that we can't see, which is interesting that you said that you feel your husband spiritually. Like, some people can't even recognize miracles in their own life. I'm curious, like, have you recognized miracles that have happened since you've left Scientology?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I mean, yes, just as far as, well, the miracle of how I got out. I mean, that alone, I feel like had something to do with, his name was Fred, had something to do with Fred. I definitely, all the time since he passed, feel good things happening to me that otherwise had never really happened before. And, you know, before he died, we had a long talk and he was like, you know, I'm still going to hang around. I want to be there for you. I mean, he kind of had a weird plan in place anyway. But yeah, I mean, I don't know if you know the way I was outed. I would have never left Scientology. I would have remained. I was born and raised. I would have remained in, but it was a whole mistake how it happened. And it was kind of pushed out. And so to me, that's a miracle in and of itself. I got therapy. I never would have done that. You know, I have my YouTube channel that I've had just a little over like a 6 months and a week. And I just hit 20,000 people following me and they're all my friends. So it's like all this support surrounding me, I would say, is absolutely miraculous. And I've never used the word miracle as a Scientologist. So, yeah. Yeah.
I would definitely say those are miracles. Wow. Yeah. Let's reframe your story a little bit and kind of talk about growing up in Scientology and what that looked like.
So yeah, I was born into it. My dad had been a Scientologist since like 1970 or 68 or something like that. I was born in 84. So he was a seasoned Scientologist and still is. And he got my mother involved in it. And I have one sister who's 4 years older. And so he was very harsh with Scientology. Just, you know, you have to apply it. He was very rigid about it. There was no not doing it. You know, there was no choice involved. And so the earliest I can remember is the age of four. And we would do training around the clock, just routines and drilling. They call it drilling. And that's all we did was Scientology at home. And that was confusing. I can't speak for my sister because she was older. But I remember being 4 or 5 years old and he was just so forceful with the stuff that I didn't know what we were doing. Like, I just was like terrified. I mean, he was very like, again, like he would just force us to, you know, do the practice and teachings of it. I was like, I don't even know what these words mean. And there's a whole other language in Scientology. You flip to a different language. And so I didn't know what they meant. And I don't know how much you know about it, but like, if you get ill at all, like a cold, if you stub your toe, if you, you know, get in trouble at school, it's called you pulled that in. Scientology believes that you, what did you do harmful? What kind of a harmful act did you commit to pull that in? So that's another constant, is you're kind of under a flashlight in Scientology, giving up your crimes all the time. So, I mean, I remember being 6 years old and I was sick and I couldn't, I think I was in first grade. And my dad was like, well, what did you do? What did, no TV, like it's a real punishment if you're sick. Like you're a lower degraded kind of person if you're ill. So, you know, a child, you know, I remember him being like, what did you do? What did you do? And he would try to pull past life crimes. So like, I'd be like, I don't know, I don't remember. And he'd be like, well, what did you do before this life? What did you do before you were born? So like really just toxic. Like I have a 14-year-old now, Raina. So it's like, I'm a mother. I've raised a child. I can't imagine talking to my kid that way, talking to any kid that way, not even my own.
Yeah, just I'm a mom too. That is scary.
Fear. Yeah. I remember my biggest memories were just being like cowering, just scared because it was this constant, like, what did you do? So then I grew up, became an adult, joined staff, all those things, and it's the same thing. It's just, you know, if you get in an accident, if you, something simple, like you, it's kind of an ongoing thing in Scientology. If you get a cold, if you get any kind of illness, we all know at this point of season, a Scientologist will go, oh, it's just allergies. It's just allergies. Because nobody wants to say they're sick because you get in big trouble for being sick. What did you do? What did you do to pull that in? And you've got to be brought in and you got to be put on the e-meter, and it's hours and hours and hours of interrogation. So it's like, oh, no, I'm just allergic to dust.
What's the e-meter? Yeah.
The e-meter is a tool that L. Ron Hubbard invented and came up with. And it's, I'm not the greatest at explaining it because I never was on the other side of operating one, but it's the main thing in Scientology called auditing. And it's similar to counseling is what they equate it to in real life. And you have an auditor that sits on the other side of it, and it's got a needle and it's a little device. A lot of people equate it to a lie detector. You hold cans that are attached to these electrodes, and the needle reads on the dial with thoughts and energy. And that's the tool they use to find your crimes or what you've done. So you can have, sometimes it's not auditing, it's off the auditing part, like where you have something called SEC checking, security checking. So they'll do that where they ask you a list of questions. And I've been having that done since I was five. And it's very, can be a dangerous tool because they can keep you on that thing for a lot, hours and hours and hours going, what else did you do? So go into a past life. What else did you do? And you have to kind of just, it's very confusing. For a kid, it's very confusing. For an adult, it's confusing. And eventually you start making things up because you just want to get out of it. You know, you're just kind of like, okay, I feel so much better. But the needle has to do certain things in order to allow you to end the session, which is what they call it.
Did you ever try to have like a heart to heart with your parents or
no.
Try to buck up in any way? Like you're like, I'm not buying this.
Absolutely not. And you don't ever do that as a Scientologist because they call it a high crime. So there's like a list of crimes that L. Ron Hubbard came up with in a book. And it's a whole structure of things. But one of them is ever questioning. You can never question. And if you do, you're subjected to that security checking for a long time, and it's on your dime. And it's, I don't know how much it is now, but I mean, it's usually like $800 an hour. So it's very expensive. And you have to sit there and have that. So it's, you learn real quick not to question anything. Just a quick, in a nutshell, I have, my mother and my sister were out since the 90s. I stayed in until a year ago. Okay.
Oh my God.
So year after year, I don't know if you watched the Leah Remini show called Netflix, the Scientology Aftermath show. Okay.
I haven't watched
that yet.
Really
good show. My mother and my sister saw that show and begged me to watch one episode. It was three seasons. And even doing that, I went to visit them in Nashville and I said, I'm going to change my plane and go home because it's like, I can't listen to this because I'm going to get in trouble just even talking about it. Like, I'm going to be subjected now because I'm going to go back. They're going to put me on the meter and go, what did you talk about? What did you do? Did you talk about anything? And that needle is going to go, what's that? What are you thinking about? What's that right there? Are you guilty of something? So I was even like, don't do this to me because I'm going to be interrogated just talking about it. So you are not allowed to question, to answer your question. You are not allowed to look. It's a big deal if you do. You're really kind of considered an enemy and you don't want to be considered an enemy.
I feel like kids kind of do that though, like naturally, like, but maybe if the stakes are so like high crime, like you're saying, or high enough, maybe they don't.
Well, I think the main way to control people is put them in a state of fear. And so I think when you are born into it, you're taught right. I mean, I can tell you, I remember sitting in my kitchen chair when I was 4 years old and my dad was like, flunk, chair, don't move. Like he was screaming at us. So it's like, I don't know that I would have been brave enough to go, this doesn't seem right. You know, I was terrified. So I think they use a lot of force in Scientology. They're very physical and they scream a lot. And that's the definition in Scientology of impingement and intention. So it's a lot of screaming happens. And if you ask why, they'll say, well, we're impinging. We're using our intention to get the point across. Like it's a good thing. It's known as a good thing to use anger. So I think that's all part of probably how other cults, all cults work, right? It's just, that's a way of, you're so scared. They have you under control and brainwashed, mind control that, I'm sure some people question it, but I know no one that did growing up.
Wow.
Nobody. You just don't want to do that. I mean, it's expensive, one, but two, they rope you into your whole life. Your dentist is a Scientologist. Your person who comes in, your plumber. I mean, you only associate with Scientologists. So they put that fear there. And if you are outed, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? You're going to lose your whole family because they disconnect. They apply a disconnection policy. So if you're outed, you lose everything. And that's a state of fear in and of itself. That's why I never would have talked, Rena. I never would have spoken out because as bad as my story is, I would have lost everybody. And I did. Overnight, I lost over 300 people. They were gone. And I'd known them my whole life. Gone. Disappeared. Died. I'd never talked to them again. They blocked me on every social media platform. It's fast. They bring down the hammer quickly. So it's a fear, right? I mean, I was out in without wanting to be. It was an accident what happened. So that's another reason I think people don't take that route, because once you're so heavily in it, and your dentist, your doctor, all your friends, your job, most people work for Scientology companies, you can't, it's too much at stake. You can't lose that. Your mother, your father, your kids, like they'll all disconnect from you. Nobody wants to take that step, that leap and question or do anything like that.
Okay, let's talk about how you were outed.
So do you know Aaron Smith-Levin?
Yes, I've watched some of your interview with him.
Okay. So he's great. He's got a pretty big YouTube channel and he's really leading with the torch on fighting Scientology. And he's the first person, I watched the Aftermath show. And on the show, they talk about a organization called, at the time, the Aftermath Organization. And it said, like, if you need help, call us. And I thought, well, I can't run to my family. Like, now that I've seen the truth. Because to be honest, I watched that show and it took me years to watch it because so many people said you should watch this. And I was like, why? So I can watch a bunch of disgruntled Scientologists whine and be victims. And, you know, that's what I thought. I was like, why? So people can cry about what happened to them and their religion. Like, if you find X Catholics, you're going to find that. That was my justification all the time. I was like, anybody who left an organization is going to complain. Poor me. So that was my rationalization. I was like, I'm going to watch this crap. So I did. And when I watched it, it was so powerful. I couldn't stop crying. It took me like a week because every episode, I was like, oh my God, that happened to me. That happened to me. And I thought I was the only one. I truly thought like it didn't work on me. I thought everybody else succeeded in Scientology except me. I was just the one it didn't work on. That's how I felt. So when I watched it, I was like, oh my God, these are not sob stories. Like, there's other people they've abused. There's other abuse cases, right? So I thought, I can't talk to my family. Of course, they're going to out me and I'm going to be in big trouble. So I called the Aftermath Foundation and I talked to Aaron. He's the first person I talked to. And I felt so safe because I was like, wow, I can say things without knowing I'm going to get in huge trouble. So we became friends for about 6 months and he and I talked all the time and he texted with me and he was like, let's try to get some people out, you know, because I was like, I'm ready to leave. How do I get out? I just need help. I want to get out. I've seen too much and I want to go. And he was like, hold on. You know, I've got this channel. He was like, maybe if you give me information, like we can expose this stuff and you can kind of stay under the radar and help, you know, with the cause. And I was like, yeah, I like that. You know, it makes me feel like I'm doing something. So for about 6 months that went on and I texted him some information about a New Year's Eve party and this chairman of the board, David Miscavige and all that. And this was information I got from my mother-in-law, who's a 40-year staff member in Scientology. And he accidentally flashed that text up on his screen during a live. And it was about a quarter of a second. I didn't see it, but a lot of people saw it. And he immediately edited it out. But at that point, the Office of Special Affairs, which they call OSA, who's like the, you know, head of security of Scientology, they're constantly watching Aaron. They're, you know, recording everything he does. I never spoke to my family again after that.
Wow.
It took that quarter of a second and they knew, and they saw my name and it was over at that point. Just that. That's what happened. So it was a total mistake. And Aaron called me and he said, he goes, I don't think they saw it. He said, I edited it out. I think we're safe. But he was frazzled. He was super rattled telling me the story. And I was surprised I wasn't. I just said, well, I was like, if this is how I go, and I guess this is how I go, let's hope that that's not the case. And I was pretty reassured by him that, like, that's not going to be the case. And they were gone. So that's how this all started. And he convinced me to start a YouTube channel and speak about it. He was like, you might as well, you know, it's out there. So I did. And it's been really therapeutic for me. I have to be honest, like just talking about it, seeing a therapist, which is a huge no-no in Scientology. And so, but that's how I was outed. Yeah.
Is your therapist at all formerly involved with Scientology at all?
No. And he doesn't know much about it, which is interesting. I've seen a couple of therapists to get to the right one. I wasn't comfortable with the first couple. Every single one I've seen, and that's another thing Scientology, when you're in, they teach you is therapy's the devil and, you know, psychiatry's trying to take us down. And once you get out of the bubble and see, they don't even really, it's not big enough to even really know what it is. All three therapists I've ever seen were like, I mean, we've heard of it, but like, it's not even really a thing for them. They're like, I don't know. I mean, yeah. So I kind of enjoyed that I was like, oh, it's not as big. Scientology, you know, gets you to believe. You know, you have blinders on and you're not allowed to look and you can't go to Google. So they get you to believe real quickly that, like, we're making serious progress and we're clearing the planet and saving everybody. And I think my channel is bigger than there are actually Scientologists active. So if that tells you anything.
Interesting.
More people. And I don't have a very big channel. So it's like, okay, yeah, that's good to know.
What made you want to tell your story? Because you could have been blown up and then you could have, like, gone to the therapist and kind of, like, you know, been a mom and not been public with it. Why did you want to share your story?
So Aaron, after he flashed my name and after we saw the fallout of what happened there, I think a little over a month went by and he was kind of talking to me. And I know he felt terrible and he knew everything that was happening in real time. And he was like, you know, I really think your story would be powerful, a powerful one to tell. Mine's a little different because I was a minor. I was underage and I was 14, having sex with a 24-year-old on staff at the church. And so he was like, you know, yours is a little bit more powerful. And I think it could reach more people and maybe get someone who's watching under the radar like you were to know that happened to me too. Kind of like me. I mean, I was like, that happened to me too. It woke me up. So that alone took a few weeks for me to think about it. And I said, I don't know. I don't know that I want to share it. You know, I'm dealing with the effects of losing everybody. I don't know. I just thought, I'm out. It's over. I mean, it's done. I lost everybody. And I thought, well, this isn't going back. I'm never going to get them back. So I might as well share and see who we can reach to go, that happened to me too. And it's wrong. you know, and I've been told it was okay, and it's not. And so I thought, I really want to help somebody. If I could reach one person, you know? And so I'm glad I did it. I'm really glad I did it. And it felt good for me to get that weight off. I've never, ever talked about it with any non-Scientologist ever. I mean, it's been well known within the church. I've complained, I've reported things, but nothing's ever been done. So it felt really good to be heard and validated by people who actually cared, you know?
Love that. Yeah, what happens if you do report it within the church?
I reported, so the guy that I slept with when I was 14, I was on staff. I was pulled out of ninth grade and put on staff. And I immediately got a boyfriend who was on staff. He was 24. And we were together for 2 years. And it was well known. I mean, people knew. My dad knew. Everybody knew. In Scientology, you're looked at as there are no children. You're just in a small body. So you're just a being in a small body. That's what we call them. So they're treated just like the rest of us. So that's alone, if you think about that way of thinking, there's nothing wrong with it. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I went full on, I think, to the age of 35 when I told my current husband about it. And he said, statutory rape. And I said, no, it's not. And he was like, yes, it is. And I said, I consented. I wasn't raped. And he said, it doesn't matter. You can't consent. Like, he was like looking at me like, are you out of, like, where are you? I still thought it was okay. So back then I was like, there's nothing wrong with this. No one saw anything wrong with it. And then I didn't report that because there was nothing to report. He was my boyfriend. But there was a guy that was like around 50 when I was on staff, and he grabbed me and he put his hands like all over me and he shoved his tongue down my throat. And it was really traumatic for me. And I reported that, and I got in big trouble for reporting that. I got an order put on me that was said, like, you're entertaining the men of the organization, you're bringing our statistics down, like, you're nothing but a problem, you know, you're hurting other people by, it was pretty wild. So that's how they deal with, that's what I mean. You learn real quick, you know, not to speak out.
Did you know on a gut level, though, like, that was wrong?
Oh, yeah. No, well, yeah, because I know how it made me feel. I was scared. I was actually at a filing cabinet at work at the, and they call it the org, the organization. I was at the org, like I always was. You work 16 hours a day. And he threw me off guard. He flipped my body around and shoved me against his filing cabinet. So it was very, like, I knew it was wrong because of how I felt. You know, the panic, the sweat, like, I started freaking out. So yeah, I knew that was wrong. But it's similar to, like I told you in the beginning of this interview, when you get sick, if you do anything like that, what did you do to pull that in? So when I reported this, it was, what did you do for him to come to you and do that? It was not looked at the other way around. So that was a little bit shocking for me and hard to process. I was 16 when that happened, and I thought I would be more protected when that happened. And the day that happened, actually, well, not the day, like a couple of days later. So when you had that order put on you, they gave me 30 days and they said, you better not do anything else. You better not get any more reports or you're going to be outed in this organization. You'll lose everything. So I was tiptoeing, right? Like, I was real careful not to even talk to anybody. I didn't want to get in any more trouble. There was a gentleman on staff who was a friend, a very close friend, like a brother to me. His name was Dan O'Connor. And I did not send, there's something called a telex machine, which I'm still like, it's foreign to me. I was in charge of it and I didn't know how to use it. And I did not send a telex for him. That was very important. It was supposed to go up to like the chairman of the board. And he flipped out and he got very upset with me and he got physical. And that had never happened with me. He, again, this guy and I were so close and he was so angry. And he picked up a fax machine and he hit me with it and in the side of the head. And I fell down and he got on top of me. And Dan was a large man. And he got on top of me and he was sitting on my stomach and he was choking me. He hit me in the face and it was so traumatic. Again, I've seen these things happen. There's a lot of objects thrown in Scientology, a lot of rage, but I had never taken part in it. I'd never hit anybody myself and I'd never been hit. So this was shocking for me. And I was trying to scream and no one was there. And his mother came in, who was really like him, very, very aggressive, very abusive, physically violent. And there was another person that came who's since passed away. And they were standing there and I said, please get him off me, like, help me. And I was struggling to breathe. And his mother pointed to me and she said, look at her. And she kind of nudged the lady next to her and she said, she's fucking out to lunch. And that's all that was said. But that's not unusual if you know Linda Nelson, that's his mother. And I think this probably whole thing lasted maybe 5 minutes. And Dan got off of me And he went with the two of them, and I immediately shut and locked the door, and I was just, I was so rattled. Again, this had never happened to me. I kind of skated by without being abused like that. And I called my father in Omaha, and I was very close to my dad at this point. And I couldn't hardly talk. And I just remember like saying like, and I was trying to breathe, and he was like, what's going on? And I said, he hit me. And my dad said, oh my God, stay locked in that room. I'll be there in 3 hours, because it was a 3 hour drive. And anyway, the point is my dad showed up. He got in Dan's face and he was like, show me what you did to her. Hit me how you hit her. And he was very upset. And it all turned into this order that I had on me. So he said, I hit her because L. Ron Hubbard says per policy, in a report policy, L. Ron Hubbard says he gave the guy a black eye because he was being out ethics. And so he was like, a followed policy. And the executive director of the organization came in, and she'd known my dad a long time, Maggie Kittinger. And she said, hold on, you know, sit down. She was like, stop yelling at him. This is her fault. And she said, tell your dad what you've done. And so I'm kind of trying to answer your question. It's long-winded, but she said, tell your dad what you've done. And I was like, what do you mean what I've done? And she said, she has a non-interrogation order put on her because she's been entertaining the men of New York. She's bringing down this organization. She's pulled this in. She's basically a little floozy, you know. And it was horrible. I mean, that's how they view things. And my dad and I, again, were very close. And that in that moment, he said to me, is that true? And I said, yes, it's true that I have an order. But I said, I reported Tom. I reported this man for what he did. And I didn't entertain him like she's saying. It happened against my will. And he just got up and left. And he said, I never want to speak to you again. He said, I'm not your, sorry, this part still gets emotional for me. He said, I'm not your father. And he said, don't ever call me again. And he said, find your own financial support. He said, because I'm not going to help you. And he said, do not ever call me again. And I was so heartbroken. And I said, Dad, don't leave. I mean, he came to save me. I felt saved. And I said, please, you know, that's not what happened. That's not how this happened. I said, please don't leave. And he left. He just left. And I don't know to this day why what happened next happened, but I started, within like an hour, I started peeing blood. Something was really wrong.
Oh my God.
And it just went downhill from there. And I was taken to a hospital, and I was in a hospital for over a week, and I had two different surgeries. I had my gallbladder removed. So I had a problem with my gallbladder. So I don't know if it was the gallbladder that caused that, or if it was a lot of, I talked to some attorneys and they were like, did you not consider that Dan beating you up and all of that like could have done some damage? And I thought, I never thought of that. I don't know. To this day, I don't know. I don't know if it was my gallbladder, but it was within an hour of that occur, all of that happening. Well, a couple hours. I think it was like 3 or 4 hours later after my dad left, I started peeing blood. And I don't know, but I couldn't get help. I mean, I was asking people at the church after my dad left. I said, I think something's wrong. I need medical help. I'm peeing blood. And they were like, oh, fuck yourself. Like, look what you just did. You just totally destroying people at this org. You know, you're bringing down people's reputations. And the guy that I was dating, Shane, the 24-year-old, took me to the hospital. He was the only one that helped me. So, and once I was in the hospital, I called my dad because they said, you're a minor. What are you doing? Like, you're a minor in a hospital bed. What's going on? Where are your parents? And I said, my dad's in Omaha. And I got him on the phone and he said, fuck you. Don't call me. He said, I do not want anything to do with you. So that's never changed. And I was hoping that would change. I had spent years hoping that maybe he would feel some sort of remorse, you know, or we would reconnect, and that never happened.
I am so sorry.
I am too, girl.
Oh my God. I just don't know how. I mean, I have a daughter that's 13. I just cannot imagine leaving her in that situation.
Yeah, I don't have a daughter, but I have a son, and he's 14. And I think the same thing all the time. Like, this all happened. Like, I was 14 when I started sleeping with this 24-year-old, and I think there were so many adults that knew about this. Can you imagine? Like, we're mothers now.
Oh my!
I would burn that place to the ground.
God.
Doing time the rest of my life.
Totally.
On a killing spree. I mean, I can't imagine that happening to my kid.
I can't imagine being okay with that. Like, how did he get to the place? Like, how did he get involved with the church? How did he become okay with that? Like, what was his upbringing?
My dad,
Yeah.
I think he always hated his mother. I'm not really sure the background there. We weren't allowed to see her, but he always hated her. And my dad really is quite hateful toward women.
Mean.
He always trashed my mom. My mom left when I was 6. I saw her a few spotty times scattered in between, but I really didn't see her again until I was 18. He would not let us see her. So he really was abusive and super high control. And it wasn't about, like, it was just about winning for him. You know, like, I'm going to keep these kids and you won't ever see these kids. And he hated us kids. You know, he didn't want us. So I think he toyed with drugs, like when he was like in his early 20s, and he found Dianetics, which was the book written by L. Ron Hubbard in 1950. And then he found a Dianetics group, and then they just kind of sucked him in. But to be honest, I wish I could go back and witness all of that, because I really, truly believe, I would say kind of like a dog that bites is a dog that bites. I believe he was a bad person to begin with, and Scientology just enhanced that, just made it okay to be even more abusive. You know, it just amplified it. I don't believe, like, he was this great guy and then he found Scientology that just turned him bad. I mean, I never hit people. You know, I was a Scientologist raising my kid up until a year ago. I never treated him that way. I think he was just a bad, bad person to begin with.
That's interesting. I am curious how you were able to raise your own kid in it. Were you able to do it in a more loving way or kind of protect him differently?
Yes, I kept him out of it. I made it clear with my husband at the time, his father, and I just, we were both raised in Scientology, and he has a horror story of that too. I mean, he could hardly talk about it. Michael, my husband at the time, he was just like, so many terrible things happened to him when he was a child. So we just agreed kind of just like silently, not, we didn't make it real clear, but like, we're never going to, my son's name is Huxley. And I said, we are never going to subject Huxley to this because of how we were raised. It was kind of a silent pact we made, secretive, you know? And so I always gave the excuse, because people were very upset that we did that, you know, in the church, and like, you need to bring him in for services. You need to put him on a course. You need to get him some auditing. And I would just say, like, he spoke way later in life. He was like over 3 years old. He didn't even talk. Now, I mean, I don't know why, but I mean, now he's super chatty. So he's not like antisocial or anything, but I would just say, like, we want to give him a choice. We want him to, you know, reach for Scientology. We kind of, you know, we want him to reach for it. And he hasn't reached yet. You know, like, we just kind of tried to string it along as much as we could. But I was never going to let that kid be involved with the can holding and the yelling. I knew I was going to protect him from that. And I did a good job at remaining and balancing being a Scientologist and going into the org and doing services and people going, where's Huxley? And I'm like, oh, he's with my mom tonight. You know, like, just really trying to keep him as much as I could away from it. And I did. I really did. He hardly even knows what it is. He didn't do anything in it.
How have you explained to him the 300 people that are not in your life anymore?
So that was really difficult because I talked about my mother-in-law, who's been a staff member for 40 years. My father-in-law, which is, so Doug and Brenda Argus are the parents of Huxley's dad, Michael Argus. They are the most diehard. They've been in for 40 plus years. He's an orthodontist, retired, but he was never on staff. He supported the family while she was on staff. And both of them, but especially, I cannot stress this more, especially Doug, was this with Huxley. I hardly saw Huxley. Doug would take him every weekend from the age of 6 months old. He loved Huxley. He could not be without him. He would come over every day to my house and tutor him after school. And I mean, they were just so close. It's a little creepy. Doug, in Scientology, people believe you don't die. You drop the body and you just go get a new body. So Dunn believed that his father died in the 70s and was waiting around for picking the right body. And he believes that Huxley is his father and waited around for that special body to pick up and be in Dove's life again. So Dove always had this master plan: when Huxley gets older and has a child, I'm just going to drop my body and be Huxley's child. It's so creepy. It's so creepy how they do that. But anyway, so I think that's what his tie was, like his emotional attachment was, this is my dad. He believed Huxley was his dad. So he spent all this time with him nonstop. And when I was outed, he dropped Huxley. He never spoke to him. He never, and I'm talking, I bet he saw Huxley at least 4 days a week, every week. And he never saw him again. And Huxley said, I can't live like this. Like, I can't, like, it's just too much of a mystery. Where did he go? It's like,
it's a void.
It's like, I don't. So he called Doug on his cell phone. See, they wouldn't take my calls. They had me blocked, but Doug did not block Huxley. And I'll tell you, it was one of the hardest things. I could not. He called him on speaker at our kitchen table one night, and you could tell they got to Doug. Doug had zero emotion. He was very regimented in what to say. It's like he had been trained and coached on what to say if this phone call ever took place. And Huxley, my kid is, I don't want to say like he's a tough guy, but he doesn't cry. Like, he's actually quite reserved. Like, if he's a man of few words, as far as like he's, I'd always say he's like a 50-year-old man. The kid has always gotten up at like 5:30 in the morning. He eats his own breakfast. He showers. Like, he's just very responsible kid. He always has been. It's funny. And so, you know, he called Doug and he was like, you know, I can't live like this. Like, what's happened? And he just lost it. Huxley just couldn't. He was like, like, he was just hysterical. And that was so hard for me because I've never seen him cry like that. Like, he just doesn't show emotion. He's always been this, like, just, I lean on him for support most of the time. He's a pound of my rock. You know, he's like, well, Mom, let's consider that. Like, I don't know. Like, he thinks things out. He's just very, he's methodical. I love him. He's my everything.
Aww.
To watch him break down like that, you could tell there was so much heavy, like, obviously, like, he just couldn't even control it. He just spewed out of his mouth. And it was so hard for me to listen to. I actually had to leave the room a couple of times, and I was just trying not to cry. And he was like, you can't leave my life. He was like, please don't disconnect from me. Like, he was, and Doug had no emotion. He was like, he was 13 at the time, Huxley. And he said, I've known you for 13 years. He was like, but this is, we've come to an end. And he was like, we won't know each other anymore. And Huxley was like, he said, what did he say to Doug? He said, my mom didn't do anything to your church. He was like, your church did something to my mom. And he was like, why can't you understand? And it was so heart-wrenching.
I love your son.
Yeah, but I mean, and he's so smart. I mean, he's very advanced in how he thinks.
Oh, my God.
It was so hard, though, to listen to Doug be this robot. And he was like, I understand. He's like, I got it. He was like, but you don't understand. He was like, I can't lose you. He was like, but I can't leave my mom, because you have a choice. You either disconnect, or you can either join Scientology, the side of family, but you've got to drop the person who was outed. So he would have had to make a choice, which legally he can't, of his mother. So he was saying, he Huxley knows how it works. So, like, disconnection, if somebody gets declared a suppressive person, which I did, that's the highest crime. That's when you're outed and you can't come back. You have to disconnect from that person, their mailman, anybody who talks to them, anybody who knows them. You can't just disconnect from the person. You have to cut every tie. So that's what makes it harder to you. It's so ugly to do that, how they divide up families. And Huxley knew that. So he was trying to, like, rationalize with Doug. And he was like, I can't leave my mom. He was like, but I don't want to leave you. And Doug was like, you know, he said, we've had a good life together. He was like, you know, I'm glad that I knew you. It's insane.
I cannot believe a grandparent could say that.
It was horrific. And we never talked to him again. That was it. He never called him again. And Huxley had to call him. Keep that in mind. Like, that story, he was like, I can't live like this. I have to have an answer. Like, it was so, he needed closure. I didn't get any closure. I lost probably about 500 total. I never spoke to them again.
God.
To this day. So, I mean, he got that one phone call, and that was it. Now, his grandmother, Brenda, Doug's wife, never spoke to him. Again, was in his life. She just wasn't in his life as often because she was a full-time staff member. They keep pretty close tabs on you when you're a staff member. Doug was not. So he had the freedom to come to our house, you know, take in places, do stuff with them year after year after year. You know, they had their routine. Brenda, not so much, because it was harder. She was under their control more. But still, like, I mean, his birthday has happened. We had our first Christmas a few months ago without everybody. We had our first birthday without everybody. That was hard. Now, the only thing that saved us was my YouTube channel. Like, we live streamed his birthday. Oh, God, that was so emotional. I had so many people send so many gifts to him and, like, lift him up and money and just, like, here, take this, go buy something. Like, we love you. We want you to feel supported. And he's got family, I can tell you that. And
that's remarkable.
They love him unconditionally. Yeah,
that's
this
remarkable.
Is conditional love.
Wow. I am so glad.
Those people changed my life in every way. Yeah. to show love from across the world. I had people send things from Portugal, from Sweden. Like, everybody on that channel sent stuff to him. Like, that's stuff that I missed out on my whole life. I had no idea that, like, people actually love people that heavily. My dad didn't even ever tell us he loved us. Like, I never got a hug from my dad. Scientology is cold as shit. There is no, it's very conditional. It's based on, you know, are you a Scientologist? Good. Are you an active Scientologist? Are you doing things in Scientology? What do you do? How much money are you donating? Like, it's all about how much are you giving to the church, you know, as far as your time and your money. And if you're not, you're not really considered a good person. So this was incredible to be showered with just like wisdom, thoughts, love, gifts, all that. They just changed my life for that child.
I am so glad. I'm trying to think about, like, do you think about why you're here? Do you ever have conversations with a higher power now? Or
I can't go there. I just don't know. Now, I've said on my channel many times, I'm always envious of people's relationship with God. Like, it makes me feel empty and a little bit like hollow when people talk about like how they were raised and their faith. I don't know what faith still even really means, but we were told there really is no God. Now, I don't believe that. I believe there's surely something, but I can't go there. I don't know what to believe. I don't know what's real. I don't know. It's just hard for me to kind of fathom that. Like, I don't know, but I'm jealous. Like, I get envious of that. People who have, like, they know where they're going. They have a plan, or they talk to God. I'm like, man, I wish I had that. Wish I could do that. I just don't know if I can. I don't know where to begin. You know, what pieces you put together to even know.
That's so interesting. Was there prayer in Scientology? What did that look like?
No. Definitely not prayer. Just the teachings of L. Ron Hubbard, the books.
Okay.
Yeah, there's definitely no praying. I mean, we praise him for sure.
Okay.
You know, there's pictures of him everywhere in every room. And whenever somebody completes a step or something, they clap and we all turn to the picture and we all go, hip hip, hooray! And they go, tell her age, and we do that. But I mean, no, there's no praying.
So what would lead to clapping for L. Ron Hubbard? I am totally being serious.
Oh, well, everybody says it. Like, you would know it as a Scientologist, like, Ron is your best friend. So, like, when you write a success story, when you finish something, you complete an action, you always have to write a success story. And almost everybody says, and to Ron, like, my very best friend in this universe, to the best friend that mankind has ever had, to Ron. It's always like, thank you, Ron, for, you know, making me a better person, for the life tools. And yeah.
Did you ever connect with that on a deeper level?
Never. I was always uncomfortable with it. I never did the hip hip hooray. I would just do the clapping because I always felt I didn't like his pictures. I never resonated with him. I never felt connected like everybody else. Everybody else was like, isn't he the best? Like, he's dead. They talk about him like he's here, you know, and all the gifts he's given us for our future and our eternity. And that's how they talk. So I never connected that way. I never felt connected. I always thought he was a little creepy looking. And I went, you know, we have to sit there all day and listen to lectures by him. So like, it's the recordings of him. And sometimes the way he would talk made me uncomfortable. I felt like he was racist in a lot of things, but also like he, Scientologists hate gays. Like, they hate anything. And that never made sense to me. My father hated gay people because Scientology, you know, he talks about it in the books. And I never agreed with that. So there were things that like tipped me off where I was like, I don't like this, but I never said it out loud. You know, I thought, why are we racist? Why do we hate gay? Like, why? And he would talk about why, you know, that they were a lower form of basically human and they should all, he says it on Science of Survival, they should all be cast off and put on an island somewhere. So a lot of things I remember growing up thinking, I don't agree with this. I never felt that way. I never felt violent enough to want to hit somebody. I never wanted to hate gay people. I just thought. So when they would look at his picture and do that, it always kind of gave me a little twinge. Like, yeah, I know that I worship this, but I sure as shit wasn't going to say that out loud. You know, I'm just going to go with it. Why? Because you're just too deep in. I was born and raised. I mean, I was deeply rooted. Everybody around me was a Scientologist. I spent my whole life in it. Like, no fucking way am I going to be like, yeah, I don't, this guy's a sleazebag. And that's how I felt about him.
Wow. Do you feel like Scientology is tied to your purpose here? Like,
yeah.
Like, do you kind of define yourself by it at all?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm working hard on that every Monday in therapy to unpack it. I'm getting so much better. It's now been a year and 3 months since I've been outed. So I'm so much better. Like, I don't immediately, like, if I do stub my toe, I don't now go, what did I do to pull that in? Like, my whole life, I'm like, I immediately start thinking, like, did I hurt somebody? Did I lie? Like, what did I do? I don't do that anymore. I don't sum people up with my training on the tone scale, which is like a scale of, you know, where someone is at in their life. And once you peg where they're at, you know, then you can tell their background and how they are sexually and how they feel about children. They train us all of that. They train us on, you remember I was telling you, my dad was like, again, start, come. You're doing all these training drills to not have emotion. They train you very hard. I've had thousands of hours of it where you sit and people try to, you know, they do things in your face. They call you a slut. I mean, I remember being 5 years old and I was doing that with a man at an org and he was like, you like to fuck little boys? Funny. Doing that to me. And I remember him saying, like, you like to fuck dogs? You like to fuck animals? Like, they do that because you flinch or you blink too much or it freaks you out or you laugh or whatever it is they're trying to get you to react. And if you react, they go flunk, and then they do it again and again and again until you don't flunk anymore. So I've been doing that since the age of 4. And so what I'm explaining to you is I don't have a lot of emotions. Like, you're trained to not react to things. That is the point of being an auditor. You're doing all this training to become an auditor. So if you have a person in session with you and they're like, and they freak out or they try to leave, you have to be...
Who would not flunk that?
Well, you do flunk, but then you have to do what's called flattening it. So you flatten that button. It's a button now. So we have to keep doing it over and over. So do you like to fuck dogs? And then I react again. Flunk. Okay, start. Do you like to fuck dogs? And then I don't react. And then they do it a few more times to make sure you don't react. And then they go, good, you passed. Good. Good job. Well done. So that's what you're trained to do. So now... Do I
It's like desensitizing you to it.
Very much. So my channel, there's a lot.
I'm like literally nauseous from that.
Yeah. I do my live streams every day and I unpack a lot of this stuff. I don't talk about it every day right now because I can't. It's heavy shit that I just can't. I got to talk about funny things, silly things, my life now. You know, I have to talk about other things. Otherwise, I just get too depressed. But I cry all the time. I can't control it. Like, I have so many like emotions now because... You couldn't do that before. So I find myself being a little over a year out now and I just burst into tears because you were suppressed from doing that. Couldn't do that. You know, so the most emotion I feel about is like sadness and tears. I don't get like rage. I don't get mad. I just think I'm so sad for all the things that, you know, they kind of come crashing in on you. But it's a great, it's therapeutic and it works for me. I don't know that that would work for everybody.
I'm kind of glad you can cry now.
I can cry now, and I do. You know, I have 900 to 1200 people watching me live, and I will sit there and cry in front of them, and that's not for everybody. You know, not everybody probably heals that way, but my channel, I say, is about healing, and so it's a safe space. I want everyone to feel like they can talk about anything in there. So some days are worse than others, but yeah, I get real mopey and emotional and weepy, and I just never did that before. You know, I remember being hard as steel, like just... I can't tell you how many Scientology funerals I've been to where it's like, they will say, no crying, no tears. Like, it's intense. Like, you're not allowed to show emotion. Now, the only emotion you are allowed to show, and it's rewarded, is rage. Like, there's a lot of throwing objects in Scientology. For him to pick up that fax machine was nothing, really. I'd seen that happen to people, just not me. So it wasn't unusual. It wasn't like a shock, you know, to do that. They use a lot of that, like, scary fear, you know, to get their point across. But crying, tears, sadness, apathy, none of that. You never see that.
Do you feel like Scientology should be shut down?
I feel like it should be burned to the ground. Yeah. Yeah. I think that they have destroyed so many people. And there have been, you know, I always kind of think this, if you want to go be a Scientologist and you're 40 years old, go fucking knock your socks off. I mean, I think it's wrong. But to bring a child and like raise a kid into it is so twisted, to like not give someone a choice or a chance. And then you fuck them up and they're just like molded into these adults that now, you know, who knows? I mean, yeah, I think it should be absolutely shut down. I think it's one of the worst things I can think of. I mean, I would have rather probably been in prison. It's really terrible what they do to people, just like how they make people feel, you know, and what they tell you and where you came from and the stories, and it's wrong. And to do that to a kid, that's not fair. I have a kid now. You have a kid now. Can you imagine doing that to your kid? I mean, it's just, it's so much abuse.
What's interesting,
no, grow up fucked up.
Is like, we tried to send our kids to like an Orthodox Jewish school that was like above where we kind of were religiously. And our oldest really questioned it for years to the point where we switched schools. And once we did that, the street we were living on, we no longer fit in. And so I honestly wish that we would have pulled our kid out earlier. I was wondering if your kid ever really kind of questioned it. It's like when you're a first time parent, though, like you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. 100%. I don't think my kid, that's terrible, by the way. I don't think my kid questioned it because I didn't let him be exposed to it enough.
Okay.
He didn't do anything. Now, when I finally told him my story, he was super affected by it. And I said, I'm going to go on this show. I was going to go on with Darren and talk about it. And I think the night before. And I was in the kitchen. I said, Huxley's my rock. The kid really gives good advice. And I said, what do you think? You know, should I do this? I said, it's, you know, the world's going to see it. And he was like, Mom, I think, he said, I didn't know that, you know, that happened to you with that older man. And he said, I think, yes. He was like, I think exposure is a good thing. And he was like, I think if you can help any other person, he asked me, he goes, would you want that to be happening to a 14-year-old girl? And I said, Huxley, you are so wise. And he said, then do it, Mom. He said, because you'll help somebody. You'll help somebody else. And I was like,
I love Huxley.
So
oh my God, you're getting chills.
He's why I didn't have more kids. I mean, he's literally why at the time I was married to his dad for 10 years. And I had Huxley in our first year of marriage. And I really questioned, I was like, should we have another child? I always kind of wanted two kids. And I thought, he's so perfect. The next one's going to be like this holy terror. And that's not fair to Huxley. Like, it'll take away my attention from him if I have some kid that, like, you know, what if the kid's mean to Huxley? And like, I don't know, it was this weird protection thing. I was like, but I love it. He's so perfect. He's like my best friend. I was like, what if I have this awful kid that just takes up all my time and Huxley gets neglected? I don't want that for him. So I just kept him. I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to chance it. He's so great.
That's wonderful. So great. I love that you have that connection with him. That's so special.
It is. And it's brought us so much closer because I didn't get to have that connection because Dunk, his grandfather, was taking him all the time. It was this weird control thing. He was every weekend. He was like, I'm taking Huxley. And I was like, okay. I mean, I was alone every weekend of Huxley's life. I had my first Thanksgiving with him last year. I'd never had one with him. Never. Dunk took him every year since he was born. I got to have my first Thanksgiving with my kid.
Oh my God. Tell me about it.
It was really special. I cooked and he helped me. And I asked him, you know, what do you want? Like, what do you normally do? Like, what's your tradition? And it was really special in our own home. He helped me cook and we had so much fun, but it was a new start. Same with Christmas. I mean, I saw him for like 2 hours on Christmas morning, but they'd come get him after that. So we got to spend our Christmas together. And so, like you asked me in the beginning about miracles, I see this as a miracle because it brought me closer to him. And it makes me feel guilty still that I allowed all of that. You know, I shouldn't have allowed it. I should have put a stop to it. I should have said, like, this is my child. But I didn't. And it makes me feel sad when I can't bring back that lost time. But I really try not to look at it that way. I try to look at it like we're building something new now. And he's not your average teen that's like, Mom, get away from me. And we do stuff together all the time. He loves going thrift store shopping, and so do I. So he's like, you want to go hit up a thrift store?
That's cute.
Sport. He plays a lot of sports. So he likes to find like basketballs, baseballs, and baseball gloves and stuff like that. So all I can do is just kind of move forward. And I left all those people behind. They're not in our lives anymore. They're not coming back. So I just think, like, build something new with Huxley. That's all I can do. And he comes on my show all the time. Everybody loves him. He's like, hey, guys, he just made the baseball team last week. And he's like, I made it. And everybody was like, woo, Huxley.
Okay, we'll clap. We'll give a woo-hoo for that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it's really, I couldn't have asked for something to fall into place the way it did. I mean, as much as it hurt me, I'm not harmed. I've got Huxley. I have all these new friends. I've got my channel, you know, and it keeps growing. I mean, I just hit 20,000 and I'm so thankful for that because these people are not just watchers. They're not just subscribers. They're my friends. I talk with them privately. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking with them outside of the channel, and I've met some of them in person. I went to Seattle a week and a half ago for my husband's business trip, and I met like 18 to 20 of them. People drove up from Portland 4 hours to meet me. Like, just, they're like, we have to meet you. Like, they took me to lunch. And I mean, how special is that? I've never had friends before. So I was like, this is incredible. It's really unfolded into something good. I always thank Aaron. Aaron feels guilty. I think to this day, you know how it happened. And I think, of course he does, right? I mean, I would feel bad too. And I always tell him, I'm like, you saved me. You saved my kid. You know, if anything, it's like, I had a life of it, but Oxley doesn't have to now. So if anything, it's like, you did us the biggest favor. You saved Huxley from being in this. You opened my eyes and it was worth it. It was totally worth it.
I'm so glad you feel that way. And I can't wait to hear about like more traditions that you and Huxley create for the two of you.
I know. I love him so much. It's so cool. We're just so much closer. I did not get to spend a lot of time with the kid. I would say 3 days a week he was with me. But otherwise, Dom came and took over. I mean, he just owned that, you know. They're very forceful in Scientology. So I would say, like, you know, maybe I'd like to spend some time. He's like, oh, we already have plans. So I'll pick him up. I'll be coming to get him. Like, it was just very, okay. And my mother all this time was like, don't let him do that. You know, don't let that happen. And that went on for years. And I just let it happen. So now, Oxley is still very sad about that. Like, I think he's shocked still. We all are. That guy literally disappeared. You know, huge part of our lives, and he's gone. But I think Huxley now sees the bigger picture, which is, I've got my mom, and that's unconditional love. I see the difference now. He will say all the time, he said it on a live recently, someone asked him about it and said, how do you feel about that? I loved his answer because I thought, good, he's not blaming himself. He said, they made their choice. And I thought, well, that's powerful. Like, that's you being in charge of this instead of going, well, I don't know why they left me. I don't know what I did wrong. Like, he's not blaming himself. He was like, they made their choice. And I'd love for Huxley to see a therapist. And I tell him all the time about my success. And he's like, I'll let you know. He said, he goes, I channel it through sports. He was like, I
that's healthy.
He's just,
that's totally, that's healthy.
My therapist says that. I talk about it every week with my therapist. And he's like, I don't think he needs, I trust him. Like, he's doing sports and he's making friends. That's all healthy steps moving forward. He's not like a recluse and isolating, and he doesn't play, you know, games all day on a screen. And he comes home from school and he's like, I'll be in the backyard kicking the football. I mean, you know, so he says that, and he's like, I channel it, mom. And he's like, I'll let you know if I need to talk to somebody, but I feel okay.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah. It's healthy. I mean, I watch for signs of it, but he's only done better.
Kids are so resilient.
I just think time really does do something, right? Like, I think the more time that passes, the better off we'll be, you know, it's less, we're healing from it.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would like to ask my dad around this?
For your dad? I'd love to see your dad sometime. I don't know. It's so cool that people have dads who care. I don't have a specific question. I would really love to hear like his breakdown, his idea of like, you know, wow, obviously you have a cool dad. So, and I've always admired dads. I get a little sad when I see people have a relationship with their dad because I just think, God, I would have. That's not all I ever really wanted. I just really like dads. I think they're cool. And I love dads that love their daughters. It's so special to me. So that's all.
No, you can adopt my dad. I love when people want to.
Oh, I bet he's adorable too.
You've heard from my mom. Now let's switch it over to Grandpa.
Got a few gray hairs again. I'm going to have to do a dye job.
This episode gave you some gray hairs?
Oh, boy. This was a lot to take in. And, you know, you asked her my first question about spirituality, and she had a very interesting take on it. Having your conscience be your guide, knowing that there is possibly a force out there, but not where it's forced on you. The irony is that God has given us choice. At the end of the episode, her son even mentions that they made their choice. This Scientology is based on human beings making up what they think the grid should be and what rules you should follow. But aren't they also made a choice of what they think right is from wrong? And even what a perfect person is supposed to be? And if you're a deviant to it, then you shouldn't be part of our clique or clan or cult, whatever you want to call it, where they want to come up with where they made their choices and everyone needs to follow their choices, where individuals don't have a choice. But that's not the way it really works, is it? If you force people to do your choice, how do you do that? You need an armed guard to force someone? You force it down their throat? And what if there's abuse that's going on? If there's abuse going on, their excuse is, you must have done something wrong. It can't be our philosophy that's wrong, that you're the reject. So isn't that the way life is with certain people? Is that if something is going wrong, it can't be them. It's got to be something around them that's wrong. And usually when people think that way, they're the ones that are misguided and are wrong. You know, a father that brings you into this world, especially if it's a little girl, and I have a little experience with that, because I've done it 3 times. These girls are looking to you for guidance and an example, and even yours truly in his younger day. I grew up on the streets. I know what it is to also have parents and grandparents that if you did something wrong, where they give you a good swift kick in the ass or the belt or a good left forearm, okay? But the fact is that as time goes on, you have to realize that you are giving an example to your children and your children's children. That cycle needs to be broken. That cycle needs to be where we have to be able to mature our logic. We have to mature our understanding of all peoples if we want to be able to have some type of elevation to the human race. But this idea is that it comes from experiences. It comes from people having choice. And when it's lacking, then there can't be the same type of growth. You need people to have growth where they can think for themselves. It's not just standing on your own 2 feet and making money, but you want people to be able to survive out there and understand that the world offers so many opportunities to grow. We don't want to be robots. We want to be able to feel and have some emotion. That's why I mentioned the spirituality, because spirituality, that's what it's about, is to let your conscience be your guide and to know that there is a more powerful source out there. And this stuff couldn't have just happened naturally. It's beyond all the rationale of science. And for a group of people to think that they have all the answers, that's why I've said it's those type of people that are misguided. And maybe the strangest thing that I heard was that they still believe in some type of natural order that you can leave this earth and be replanted into a new body. How could that be scientific or logical? That would have to be also where all these people would have to believe that there is some type of supernatural way of coming back. That doesn't happen automatically. You don't read that in a science book. So there's a lot of hypocrisy that I saw in this interview. But what's nice about Reese also is that she was looking for just one simple thing from her father, and that was love and understanding, and if a terrible event happened to me, that my father would have my back. And for a father not to have your back or to rush to a scene to try to rescue you and then leave you in the forest or leave you with the animals to eat you up, that's just horrifying to me. And for her to be able to overcome that and to be able to tell her story and share that so candidly, she deserves a lot of praise and understanding and love for what she's doing, because she is trying very hard to make a new choice and to be able to help people and to tell her story. And this is what podcasting can do, is that it doesn't have to be filtered. It can be real, and it can touch people where it's not mechanical or robotic, but it's human and humanized, the way for us all to communicate without filters. And it really helps us all, the more stories and the more people that have experienced certain things that they have in common, guess what? We can all be friends. We can all get real with each other and help each other our whole lives. We can really connect with people that feel us. And there's no science in that. That's love. That's understanding. That's humility. That's loyalty. And what she's been taught as a little girl is abuse and oppression. What kind of science is that?
And yet, she still sees her son as a miracle and wanted to protect him of that.
And that's all she asked for. That's all she asked for. And the truth of the matter is, she's doing that. And I am so happy and glad that she has a son that has responded. And let's face it, the grandfather took that child every weekend, and he was able to distinguish the two different worlds. And he chose love and understanding, and understands what the word means of choice, and that you as an individual make most of the choices in your life, and there's no excuses to winning or losing. You make the choices, and your hard work, your understanding, your perseverance will determine your destiny. Not a group of men with a closed door with a couple of books where they think they're so smart.
All right. I think you earned those gray hairs.
Thanks. I'll try to get rid of them next week. Anyway, Reese, if my two cents of wisdom means anything, I'm happy to share it anytime. I think you're a very brave lady and have overcome some adversities that are just unimaginable. You're a hero.
Thanks for listening. Now I think I'm going to go call my dad.
I'll say goodbye and see you the next time.
Thanks for listening to the Better Call Daddy show. Join us weekly for new episodes and more daddy wisdom.
Better Call Daddy is good advice always.
Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. You can also find special episodes on my YouTube channel, and you can listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Amazon Music, Alexa, or your preferred podcatcher. That's a wrap for now.